A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 18, 1985, in the series God, Our Ally, entitled The God Who Cares. The text for the sermon is 1 Peter 5, verses 7 and 10. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
God is our ally. He is the God who cares about you. From different angles, from various passages of Scripture, we've been trying to make that point, that God is our ally. And today the focus is very specific, it's very personal. The word is that God cares about you. He is the God who is there for us. He is the God we cannot flee. He is the God that we need, and beautifully, the text of the morning says, He cares about you. It is that personal and that specific. He cares about you. The word comes from Peter, and the passage that we read contains the seventh verse, which contains an imperative and a promise. Cast your cares upon Him, for He cares for you. Let's begin with the promise first. He cares about you. I want to begin with that promise because I want to set the stage for giving you the invitation. I begin with that promise because that promise holds within it a total world and life view. Let me remind you about where we left off last week when I said that there's a great watershed in human opinion, in human faith. And that watershed is that ultimate decision. Either I believe that there is someone, or I believe that there is no one. Either I believe that I'm on my own, standing alone, facing the darkness, with no one to whom to call, no one to whom to cry, on my own, left to my own resources and my own ingenuity for the space of time that is mine. Or I believe there is someone. Someone to whom I can look, to whom I can speak. Someone who is my ally. That's the basic watershed. That's where the decision of faith divides. Both decisions are decisions of faith. I think that's important for us to realize. I don't want to belabor the point, but those ultimate positions that we take are finally not the end of a logical syllogism. They are finally the decisions that we decide upon in the inner sanctum of our own heart. If you want to pursue that, read Hans Küng's book, Does God Exist? He quotes one of the leading logicians of the time, Wolfgang Stegmüller, a German thinker, who says the philosophers and the skeptics and the metaphysicians do not like to be told that all of their knowledge is based, first of all, on a faith commitment. But he says such it is. And it's really interesting in that whole area of philosophical understanding today, there is a recognition that there are some ultimate decisions that we make, and then on the basis of those ultimate decisions, we go on and we build our philosophy, we use our reason, we exercise our rationality, but finally, at the heart of things, we decide, we make a decision of faith. Is there no one, or is there someone? And once we have made that decision, and we are, after all, a people of faith who believe in God through Jesus Christ. Once we have made that decision that there is someone, it still remains for us to determine the nature of that someone. Once we have agreed that there is some divinity, some deity, some divine principle, some supreme being, then we still have to know the nature of that divinity. For example, In the 4th century B.C. arose a school of philosophy called the Stoics. Stoicism manifested itself through those early centuries and into the Christian era, into the 2nd century A.D., when it was when it found expression among some Roman thinkers. The Stoics didn't deny God. They affirmed that there was a divine principle of rationality permeating the whole of reality. Now, they were pantheists. That means that they saw God mixed up in everything. They didn't see God over against them, apart from them, beyond them, but they saw God permeating the whole cosmic drama. God in us, God in a leaf, God in a tree, in a flower, in a raindrop, God in everything. And they didn't see the universe as capricious or arbitrary. Everything was moving according to a principle of divine reason. But the Stoic believed that because everything was permeated by that divine rationality and everything was unfolding according to a predetermined plan, that his particular life, his individual life, was also caught up in that total determinism. And so really he was at heart a fatalist. You might say that the Stoic didn't say there was someone, but he said there is something. Not someone to whom to call, to whom to speak. Not someone who could be present with him, but something that was permeating the very structure of reality as it wound on its way in a vast cosmic machine. My life, my fate, caught up in it. So for the Stoic, the way to peace was to resign oneself to the inevitability. For the Stoic, you set your jaw, you clenched your fist, and you faced life unflinchingly. I met a number of Christians that I'd like to give a good dash of Stoicism to. Because there's something heroic about the Stoic. That rhymes, doesn't it? Something heroic about the Stoic. He faced life's adversity unflinchingly. He had a certain nobility about him. The kind of strength of character. He said, if whatever will be, then it's foolish to fight it. It's foolish to complain against it. It's foolish to bloody one's head against a brick wall. Why not simply resign to it? And so we still use the word Stoic when someone faces adversity with calm equanimity. But the reason he has calm equanimity is that he has convinced himself not that there is someone, but there is something, some rational principle permeating all, and therefore it's no use complaining, it's no use praying, it's no use seeking any alteration in the situation of one's existence. Resign oneself to it and find a certain peace in simply bowing before it. Now that's a possible adjustment to life. That's the Stoic. But it's not the biblical God, not the God revealed in Jesus Christ, not the God that Peter was talking about. Peter said, He cares about you. That's the promise. Peter said not that there is something, but Peter said there is someone. And he further said that someone cares. And that's quite a different proposition than the Stoic conception of things. He cares about you. Not a something, but a someone. Not a principle, but a heart that beats with love. Henry Nouwen, in his little Meditation Out of Solitude, talks about the word care. It's an interesting word. It has taken on a certain ambivalence. For example, if you say, I'll take care of him, you may be communicating an imminent attack rather than some tender compassion. Now, you could mean tender compassion, I'll take care of him. But that word has also come to mean, in our common parlance, I'll take care of him. And then the word also has taken on another flavor You want to go to the movies? I don't care. You want soup for supper? I don't care. You want to sit out on a deck? I don't care. Maybe it means all of the alternatives are equally desirable, and I don't really care. Let's do this or that. It doesn't matter. But maybe it means, and I think this is subtly what care has come to mean, then I don't care, is I don't give a hoot about anything. I don't really care. I'm not engaged. I'm not involved. I don't really care. It's kind of a despair, kind of a futility, kind of a throwing up of one's hands. Sort of a boredom, sense of meaninglessness. Apathy. That's what that usage has come to mean. Apathy. And one who is apathetic is one who is without feeling. Now when Peter says he cares about you, that's not that kind of usage of the word care. For the care in that text is rather the care in its original derivation, which comes from the old Gothic language, kara, K-A-R-A, which meant to grieve with, to cry with, to lament with. The original derivation of the word care bespoke a kind of presence with one in the midst of difficulty and darkness and pain. And when the text of Peter says he cares about you, that is precisely the kind of meaning that is seeking to come to expression. God cares about you. Now and says that it's painful to care for another in that sense. He's obviously talking about the care between individuals, and he says it's much easier to go into a situation and to bring a cure rather than to care. To bring a cure through advice or solutions. And we don't mind going into a situation if we can be the Mr. Fix-It. But Nolan says genuine care is that willingness to go into the darkness of another with a sense of powerlessness, sharing the powerlessness, sharing the not knowing, sharing the not being able to heal and being present to another in their pain and in their darkness. In the silence. That's care. Cure without care is violent. Then the one who cures comes into the other and becomes the manipulator, the ruler, the controller of the situation. That we're comfortable with that. Have you ever said to me, as many of you have, you know, I would go to such and to thus and so or so and so, I would go to them, but I don't know what to say. We don't like to go where we don't know what to say. Whenever we go somewhere, we want to come with words. We want to come with cure. We want to come with solutions, with advice. We'd all like to play God and be Mr. Fix-It. But to go into someone else's pain and simply to be there and to absorb it into oneself, to be present to another in silence, not having an answer, that's care. And God cares about you. We wouldn't mind it if he'd play Mr. Fix-It, would we? Sometimes in our darkness we cry out, "Why don't you do something?" Even if his doing something would invade our area of freedom and responsibility. We wouldn't mind being crowded just a little bit. We wouldn't mind having him move in upon us and impinge upon our turf if he would do something to fix it, to dissipate the darkness, to assuage the pain. Why don't you do something? He doesn't do something. He stands with. He is present too. Because he cares about you. He doesn't do something that would reduce you to a marionette on the end of a string. He's not the divine manipulator, taking away all of your darkness and removing all your pain. He cares about you. He's present. He is not apathetic. He is one who feels deeply. He is touched by that which touches you. He is moved by that which moves you. He is affected by that which affects you. Far cry from the stoic divine principle of rationality that permeates the whole of reality. This is one who at the heart of reality has a pulsating heart that beats with love and whose love manifests itself in a grace that pours forth out of his heart to you. He cares for you. Some of you have studied the interesting book by Scott Peck, The Road Less Traveled. A psychiatrist who wrote this book in 1978 before he was consciously a Christian. Fascinating book. He starts out by saying, life is difficult. You say, well, I don't have to pay $9.95 to find out life is difficult. I knew that already. But he says, life is difficult, and he says, why do you complain about it? What's it supposed to be, easy? Life is difficult, it's a series of problems, and with a series of disciplines, you handle those problems and you grow spiritually. That's what life is all about. That's what he claims. The interesting thing, in his pre-conscious Christian days, he wrote the book and so many people wrote to him and said, you're Christian, that he went out and got baptized. He really did. He went out and got baptized. He's now consciously, deliberately, a Christian because he discovered this whole thing and found out that what he discovered was what the Christian faith is all about. But the last quarter of the book deals with grace. And out of his psychotherapy, dealing with many, many people over many, many years, he became convinced that there is a power outside or beyond ourselves that is nurturing and that is sustaining and that moves us towards spiritual growth. He says, you can't explain it. But it's there. He said, I've seen it everywhere. And he's got a long discussion about it, which I can't go into. But his point is this, that he said, religious people call that God. And he said, I call it the power of love, whose source is God, and whose manifestation is grace. So that in the world, you live in the very center of the vision of God. In the very center of his concern and his care. This is a man writing now before he's consciously a Christian. And he's talking about a grace which is everywhere present, which is nudging us and moving us towards spiritual wholeness. Well, it took him a long time to find out what you learned in Sunday school, and that's that God cares about you. You see, he's your ally. He's not your adversary, he's your ally. He's not against you, he's for you. He's not out to break you, but to make you. He cares about you. That's the promise. Now here's the imperative. Cast your cares on him. I deal with the promise first because I want to set the stage. Because if I just start with the imperative and tell you, cast your cares on him, don't be anxious. Stop worrying. Then there are some of you that never worry anyway because you never think deeply enough to worry. But there are others of you that worry all the time. And I always worry about worry warts. Worry warts worry about things they hadn't ought to worry about anyway. And when you say don't worry, they begin to worry about the fact that they worry. And then they not only have the burden of worry, but they have the burden of guilt because they're not trusting God enough because they worry. So I'm always sensitive to worry warts. So I don't start out simply saying, don't be anxious. Even though Jesus said, be not anxious. And the psalmist said, cast your burdens on the Lord. And Paul said, have no anxiety about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be known unto God. And the peace of God that passes all understanding will guard and keep your minds in Christ Jesus. So it's a biblical theme throughout. So what Peter says is consistent with the whole testimony of Scripture. He says, cast your cares on Him. In the original language, that's a Greek aorist. That means a deliberate, once-for-all act. It means get rid of the load. It means pitch it. It means bundle up all of those cares and cast them to Him who cares for you. There's that old song, pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, 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 isn't it? Well, of course, that's pure humanism. So you pack up your troubles and put them in your kit bag and then you smile. A lot of good that does. It's like whistling in the dark to convince yourself you're not afraid when you're really scared to death. The biblical imperative is cast your cares upon Him because of the promise He cares for you. And as I said at the beginning, that's a whole world in life view. That means at the center of things there's not no one but someone. And the someone cares. And the someone is able. And so He says, why don't you give that load to Me? Cast your cares upon Him. Writing down all the things that are eating away as an acid at your peace of mind. Put down all of the things that are robbing you of that serenity and tranquility. Take a moment and think, what are the things that really seem to be bugging you? What is undercutting the confidence of your life? What are you worried about? Chances are, a lot of the things you're worried about aren't in your control anyway. We worry best about the things we can't change anyway. And we worry most about the things that never happen anyway. But that's who we are. But the invitation of the text, the imperative of the text is, get a handle on all of that. And then recognize that there's a place to go with it. Cast it on Him who cares for you. There was an old Methodist bishop who tells a story that I love. He was terribly weighed down with all the cares of the church, the burden of the church, all of the things that were going wrong and all of the problems and all the turmoil and all the strife. And with all that heavy load he was carrying on his shoulders and in his heart, he couldn't sleep. He was restless and he paced the floor and he sat down, sat up, restless, drained of energy, exhausted, but unable just to shut it off and find his rest and his peace. And he says, in the middle of the night, it was like the voice of God that said, you can go to sleep now, quail. I'll sit up the rest of the night. That's a beautiful moment, if you've ever had it. When you feel you're just about to get sucked under, pulled under, you can't really negotiate it anymore. And then that glimpse of reality as it is breaks through and you realize that there is someone and that someone cares and that means He feels with, is present to, is moved by, engaged with all that pertains to you. And you dump the load. And a moment of conscious and deliberate turning over to Him who undergirds you and overshadows you, who is your ally. The prelude to this text is humble yourselves beneath the mighty hand of God and He will lift you up. And I suppose that too is a key. Have you ever done that? Just personally, in a moment of consciousness in His presence, turned yourself over, humbled yourself. Henley wrote a great poem called Invictus, in which he celebrated the fact that he was the captain of his soul, the master of his fate, and he thanked whatever gods may be for his unconquerable soul. And he said, you know, his head was bloodied but unbowed. And Dorothea Day paraphrased him a little bit, said, "Out of the light that dazzles me, bright as the sun from pole to pole, I thank the God I know to be for Christ, the conqueror of my soul. Since His the sway of circumstance, I would not wince nor cry aloud. Under that rule which men call chance, my head with joy is humbly bowed." Humble yourself neath the mighty hand of God, and He will lift you up. In the conclusion of that chapter, Peter says that He will finally strengthen you and restore you and establish you. Who? Listen to it. The God of all grace. No wonder Peter ends with doxology. To Him be dominion forever and ever. Blessed be His holy name. He cares about you.